WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dee Dee Allen, is considered a master film editor. One of her achievements is editing the classic pool shark movie, The Hustler.
Two ball, side pocket. Very good shot. You know, I got a hunch, fat man. I got a hunch it's me from here on in. One ball, corner pocket. I mean, that ever happened to you? Where all of a sudden you feel like you can't miss? Because I dreamed about this game, fat man. I dreamed about this game every night on the road. Five ball. No, this is my table, man. I own it.
13 ball. 7 ball. 4 ball.
Game.
That was Paul Newman and Jackie Gleason. Some of the other films Dee Dee Allen has edited include Odds Against Tomorrow, Bonnie and Clyde, Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico, Night Moves, The Missouri Breaks, Reds, The Breakfast Club, The Addams Family, and The Wonder Boys, which has just been re-released. She received the 1999 Career Achievement Award from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. She was the first editor to ever receive this honor. Editing is essential in shaping the narrative and rhythm of a film, yet we often aren't conscious of it. But in the film Bonnie and Clyde, the editing of the final shootout was remarkable. The two bank robbers were hit with dozens of bullets, and we saw their bodies twitch and jump with the impact of each hit. Adding to the impact were the rapid edits that conveyed the fury of the bullets and also showed the action at varying speeds. It's always interested me about that scene. There's really so little blood for so many bullet holes. It's almost as if there's a double standard in what violence was acceptable, that the bullets were okay, but not the blood.
Well, an interesting thing, which is a parallel thing to this, is when we saw it, it was at a preview, and Arthur almost died because everything was so bloody and so red. And I spent 11 more days at Technicolor to get the tone that Arthur wanted. I mean, he was just distraught. It was a great preview. You know, it saved our lives, that preview. But the color was pretty heavy and dense, and the blood was very, very dark. And I don't know how that quite relates to the bullets, but certainly I don't think Arthur was ever interested in having violent blood spurting out, unless there was a real reason for it, because basically this was a film that he made after the Kennedy assassination. And I've always felt that that last scene was a kind of a symbolic scene about the violence in America, which of course still exists.
You're one of the first successful women film editors. How did you first get your foot in the door in the 1940s?
Well, I was going to college at a place called Scripps College in Claremont, California. I'm not from California, but that's where I went to college. And between my sophomore and junior year, it was 1943, the middle of the war. Faith Elliott Hubley and I were the first two girl messengers hired at Columbia when the guys went off to war that summer. And I never finished college. I just stayed messenger for 10 months, and that was 4 years in sound before I ever got a chance to touch picture. And I never did that in the 4 years at Columbia. I was a sound effects editor, and I think that has a lot to do with whatever rhythm people say I have.
So how do you think learning to edit sound effects influenced you as a film editor?
Oh, I think tremendously, because I have no fear of sound. I worked when it was optical. You used to look at the stuff and see it. And then later, when we went to MAG when I was in New York, you know, it's just as easy. You just learn a different, you don't look at it, you just hear it. And sound has always been very important. It is very important to me. I don't like to show even a first cut unless it plays sound-wise. And of course, in those days, it was hard to make it play sound-wise because you had one track. You didn't have two or three tracks. You didn't have an Avid or any of those things.
An Avid is a digital system of editing.
It's a digital system, yes. Although it goes to film ultimately, you know, when you screen and you go to prints, you're cutting on numbers and little pieces of information which come out as a picture.
When you were first learning how to edit film, were there certain rules that you were told were basically unbreakable that you've subsequently broken?
Oh, yes. I remember one man, a very, very generous man, who was doing Ann Miller pictures, and he took me in and said, I want to teach you something. He said, you always start with a long shot, then you move in to an over-shoulder or a group shotter. And he said, and you never change that order. Of course, when I started cutting in the years in New York before I could get features, I was working in what was called a spot house, and I was doing industrials and things. And somehow or other, I was breaking that rule constantly. I was doing medical films where, you know, I just didn't seem to think about that way. When I got a chance to cut for Bob Wise, I was terrified. He was, after all, Orson Welles' editor, and, you know, and I was very impressed. This was the first picture he also was in charge of producing. It was Harry Belafonte was producing a picture called Odds Against Tomorrow, 1959, and I was by then 34 years old. And I had started when I was 18, so that's was a long route to get there. But the first Saturday that I ever showed Bob Wise my first scene, it was a scene up on Riverside Drive in a clunky apartment where Ed Begley and Robert Ryan first meet with Harry Belafonte, and Robert Ryan plays a very racist bank robber. And I worked that scene over and over and over again. And in those days, you had hot splicers, meaning big foot splicers, where if you lost a frame, you had to slug it in black. And so the first sequence that I showed him, it had what I used to call little blackies in them, you know, little black slugs in them. And he looked at the scene and he punched me on the arm and says, good girl, I like to see you've been working with that. Never be afraid. I said, oh, I was so afraid. All my mistakes would show. He says, no. He says, you've been working the scene. It wasn't like a time now where, with the Avid or something, where you can do it any one of a dozen ways and nobody sees your mistakes. He was just so encouraging. I mean, I couldn't have had a better mentor as my first big feature.
If you're just joining us, my guest is film editor Dee Dee Allen. Among the many films she's edited include The Hustler, Bonnie and Clyde, Little Big Man, Dog Day Afternoon, Reds, The Addams Family, and the current film The Wonder Boys. She received the 1999 Career Achievement Award from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. She's the first editor to get that honor. Let me ask you about the film The Hustler, one of the early films you edited. This is the 1961 classic about pool hustlers starring Paul
right.
Newman, George C. Scott, and Jackie Gleason. It was directed by Robert Rawson. In the pool scenes, there's a real great rhythm between the pool shots, the view of the table, and the cutaways to the reactions of the players and the spectators. And in some scenes, the pace seems to just escalate as the game goes on and tension increases. Can you describe your approach to editing those pool sequences through the film?
Yes, actually, the pool sequences were the first things that were shot. We were in Ames Pool Hall for a long time, and I was back in my cutting room, cutting it. And when we shot what became montages, and even the ones that weren't montages, as the pace increased in that whole sequence at the beginning of the first big game that Minnesota Fats wins, it was long, but it played. This is the point I think I'm trying to make. It played long. And then when we started montaging it, I would take the black and white without even going to what was then called a fine grain, which was a way you would put it out in a black and white film. Ultimately, you would go to a finer grain and then re-photograph it from that. I would take the black and white and do what I call quick and dirty montages. And that's the manner in which we did the first one. Once it was, say, a full reel, and I got it down to then a half a reel, and then, you know, this is for each montage. Some of the montages were faster. It was a process. It's all a process. But if a scene played, Rawson would tell me, well, it's kind of a, he said, don't pish in the mustard. It's kind of a dirty expression. I don't know if you can use that. Don't improve it into a disaster. But he was a fantastic story man. I mean, he really knew. We would switch scenes around. We would go up and just switch scenes, play them differently. And we had to lose one of the best scenes that Paul was just heartbroken in the pool hall because it was very similar to what the story told in another scene. And even though it was, as far as Paul was concerned, a better scene for performance, it had to go. And that was the kind of thing Rawson was good at. We just never had a chance to totally finish the cutting down. And as I said, sometimes he didn't want refining scenes.
Who explained to Paul Newman that the scene had to go even though he loved it? Did you have to do that?
Probably Rawson.
You were spared from that yourself?
No, I didn't. I mean, you know, he came to all the dailies and... well, I could tell. I'm sure Paul wouldn't mind if I told this funny story on Rawson. He would sit with me, and Paul would come up afterwards, and he'd start telling me how he felt about the scene, what he wanted. And then Rawson once said to me, never pay attention, because he wants Eddie Felsen to be a good guy. Actually, he's not a good guy. Bobby Darin could have played him. You know, he's that kind of a bad guy. And he says he wants him, because he's such a good person himself, he wanted Eddie Felsen to be nicer than he really was.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Does it ever happen that you have a scene and no matter how many takes you did, there was always one actor for whom the scene worked and another actor that wasn't at their best? And then
happens all the time.
Yeah, and in the final edit, you have to decide which actor is going to get their good performance in the scene and who's going to get
their... I don't think you think of it as an actor whose good performance is there. I think you have to protect actors always. I'm a great believer in... never allowing even fine actors sometimes have tics that they do. They don't even know they do. You know, and once in a while I see them in a movie and I think, Jesus, why did the editor not, you know, help that actor a little? That's not, I think, what you do. You play the scene for the scene. And if there's a weak actor generally, you just play it slightly differently. You know going in that you've seen the dailies enough. I memorize all my footage and I put them all in a certain order and memorize them, and I know where the weak parts and the strong parts are. And if you don't have all equal actors, you wouldn't even think of trying to do that unless it helped the scene to do that at occasion, you know, or once in a while you'll use a mistake or something that isn't quite right to make a point. It just completely depends. Always a matter of choice when you're starting. How do you decide who to play what line on?
You know,
I'm not intellectual that way. I don't sit down and graph it out. I go completely by gut.
So you like to be at the rehearsals if possible. You like to be on the set. You like to see the dailies. Do you ever worry that will influence your decision? In other words, when you're actually editing a movie, that a scene might look different than your memory of it, or than the way it played on the set, and that you'll be kind of too influenced by the way it played on the set.
Well, that's a good question. That's a very good question, because actually I don't like to be on the set. I don't want to know who's fighting with who, who's screwing who. I don't want to know any of that. That doesn't interest me in any way. I'm only on the set when I'm called on the set.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I don't really go on the set. I never go on the set. Because I like to look at the film, and for me, it's fresh.
Right.
And I don't have to know any of the baggage that goes with making it.
My guest is film editor Dee Dee Allen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film editor Dee Dee Allen. Her movies include The Hustler, Bonnie and Clyde, Dog Day Afternoon, Reds, and The Wonder Boys, which has just been re-released. What should a good editor do to watch out for an actor?
Well, you just don't put anything. You never make an actor look... For instance, it's if a woman is going up a staircase and there's a camera following her and it's someone who's being photographed, even if they have a very slender figure, sometimes they can look a little wobbly in the rear end. You would never put a shot like that. And I've sometimes seen things like that where actors weren't protected as much as they could, or an actor has a bad tick in you, or they take a breath, or they take that pause that you know is a preparation. And I've sometimes seen those left in films. And that's someone who just didn't know that they could get rid of that and cover it and not show where an actor basically paused because they were doing a prep. You have to know when they're really into the character and when they're not. It's a matter of knowing good acting, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You've seen the technology of film editing change a lot since the 1940s when you started as an apprentice. Tell us how you made an edit when you first started and how you make them now digitally.
Well, when you first start, you make an edit on film. You cut it on a splicer, and the splices have all changed, too, because they used to be... Or you do it with a scissor. I beg your pardon. I haven't gone back far enough. You do it with a scissor, and you would lose one side of the frame. You would lose a frame between each cut.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to put... There are some even, I think, in 16 mil when you would lose two frames. I can't quite remember, but that's what I meant when I was talking about the Bob Wise first scene I ever cut.
Right.
If you lost the frame, you had to slug it, and you would slug it in black because that shows better than white. You wouldn't slug it in white because that would flash bright. So you would see the thing chatter with these little black things going through. I remember at Columbia, where I first started, I never got into the picture department there, but I remember before a preview, there would be these, I would go up sometimes and be called in to help clean the film. They would clean the film within an inch of its life and replace any slug that was in it for the preview, and you would have your hand in a big double tin of carbon tet, which became very dangerous later, and you would squeegee it through velvets very, very slowly to clean it up for the picture.
Carbon tet is like a dry cleaning fluid.
Yeah, well, it's something used to be used for cleaning film, but it's a noxious one. I mean, it's not, you know, you can get very sick from it.
Right.
But we didn't know that in those days.
And now you're editing digitally.
Now I'm editing digitally. Then there was the period when you had tape, of course. You know, you spliced it, and then you had the period of the Carlos Rivas, which is a straight splicer where you only have to put one sprocket. And then Walter Murch developed one where you only had to put a half a sprocket, a little tiny thing where you never saw the tape. I mean, each generation contributes. It's wonderful.
Did you ever find yourself resisting change and preferring it the old way, or did you go along with all the changes and welcome them?
You can't work in this industry if you resist change. I happen to love equipment. I mean, when I lived with my grandparents the last 3 years of high school, I would fix the plumbing and stuff like that. My grandfather was a surgeon. He wouldn't touch anything like that. So I was always had fun with my mechanically, so I had no trouble with moviolas and things like that because mechanically I kind of liked them.
When you started off in movies, you were hoping to one day direct, but you stayed in film editing. What did you love, and what do you love, about editing films?
It's a very exciting profession because you really get to play other characters. You get into a story, and that story becomes real to you, sometimes at the expense of your own family, to be honest. And I suppose it's like an escape. I think movies were always an escape for me. And it's an escape into something that I was so privileged to be allowed to get into and to do. And I was always so grateful for the opportunity of getting that I never got tired of it. But also my husband in a different field, he was in news and public affairs, he became a director. He was a writer who became a director and producer and so forth. And there came a period in our lives when our children were teenagers where I would never have thought of, you know, I had a chance to start directing maybe twice that were a real chance. And I decided it was not the time to start competing. A marriage, both people were working, is competitive enough. And at that point, and maybe it was too late in my career. I was probably well into my 50s before I got my first chance.
Now, you told us that at the beginning of the career, where you first got into the editing room was during the war and a lot of men...
Second World War.
Yeah, and a lot of men...
We have to say that these days.
And a lot of men who had jobs were off fighting the war, so there were more openings. Do you think anything was more difficult for you as a woman? Were there any obstacles put before you? Were people willing to mentor you in spite of the fact that you were a woman?
That's a word that wasn't used in those days. Nobody... I used it... In terms of, I think I used it earlier in the interview because I've heard it so much lately.
Right.
Obviously, there are people who encourage you. I mean, I never would have been able to get ahead in anything because I was working mostly with men, unless the men who helped me were encouraging. I mean, that's, as far as I'm concerned, it took in my generation, certainly, men to help women. You just couldn't go blasting your way. After all, you had to, the hardest thing to do is to be able to learn everything of what goes on in a laboratory and not be considered, an overbearing ball buster is the word they used to use. I guess they still do. They use worse words now. Anyway, it's very hard to retain yourself as a woman and still be knowledgeable. And the only way you can do that is to learn everything you have to know about everything so that nobody can fool you. And laboratories were a wonderful place because I ended up with great relationships with people in labs because I had come from having cut commercials and industrials and laying out my own opticals. So I knew labs and I knew the people who did the opticals and I knew what you could do. And when you know your stuff, they respect you. They don't think of you as a man or a woman, but it took in every a new relationship in the early days, it took going through that period of their learning that I really didn't know what I was talking about. So you had to work harder. I think it's as simple as that. I'm not sure that isn't still true today. I don't know.
Film editor Dee Dee Allen, she's now editing the film John Q, starring Denzel Washington, directed by Nick Cassavetes. She recently edited the film Wonder Boys, which has just been re-released. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.